All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, March 21st, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everyone. It is a chilly 29 degrees and overcast, but no snow here in upstate New York. And happy spring. It arrived yesterday. I don't know, maybe around midnight or 1 a.m., maybe the day before. But happy spring. You don't know how much I've been waiting for this. For any of you who live up in the northern latitudes, you know what I mean. By the end of March, you're going a little bit stir crazy, and it is time to get some sunshine on your head and start to thaw out and get out of this Stanley Hotel you've been trapped in all winter. So where we leave off on Friday, we titled the show Quantum Dots, Nano Cancer Cures, Plastic Water, and Nano Food Packaging. And that was like show number 7 on nanotechnology. And I promised myself that today I was going to move on to another topic, but it doesn't seem like that was in the cards because our friend and listener Camille dug into a little bit more research and found some very disturbing stories that connected more dots to the horror that we've been looking at. So I might touch on a few of those this morning first thing before we continue on. And I'm going to cross my fingers. Maybe Friday, Camille's going to come on and share some of the research that she's discovered. So we were looking at nano and food packaging and the fact that the National Institute of Health is concerned that maybe some of this nanotechnology can leach into our foods. We also read about some of the testing that was done out of the University of New York at Fredonia in regards to 11 different brands of bottled water and how they were finding all kinds of plastic fibers in many of the bottled waters. And what a concern that is, because they don't know what effect that could possibly have on the human body, but they have found with nanotechnology, it doesn't necessarily get flushed completely out of your body, but it's stored in organs such as your liver and your spleen, and it could potentially be toxic, so you want to be careful. So there's another story out of the National Institute of Health, and I think pretty, this is where we closed up the show on Friday. It was looking at the different ways they could use nanotech in packaging. One of them, of course, was in oxygen scavengers, and that would be to keep your food fresher longer. They were also looking at making some sort of smart packaging system where they can bag and tag and track and recognize what kind of foods are in there, what the expiration date is, how much oxygen is in there, be able to keep track of food at a granular level. They also have CO2 sensors, pathogenic microorganism sensors to tell whether or not there's bacteria or viruses in the meat, salmonella, E. coli, things of that nature, freshness indicators, temperature indicators, humidity indicators. This is frightening. And so where does that leave us? Well, we've read a lot about DARPA working on minuscule sensors, biosensors, and they've even turned plants into little mini spies that can monitor the environment. We've also read about smart dust and the promise of smart dust to be able to wirelessly connect, whether that be through some sort of 802.11 or Bluetooth or satellite, microwave, to be able to connect real-time statistics, whether it be vibration, heat, humidity, like some of the things we were reading about in the environment, and be able to bag and tag resources and supply chains, like shipping containers and that, so they could watch it real time. Well, nanotechnology has a big part in that. And where they started a lot of that development was in our favorite surveillance device, and that would be our smartphone. That smartphone that sucks you right in with the pretty pictures and the dangling carrot of that dopamine button to have things available 24/7. And I'm going to tell you, I've actually started a little experiment on myself, and it's kind of scary. My cell phone finally died a few weeks ago. 7 years. It was pretty clunky, and the operating system didn't allow me to download any type of apps anymore because it was so old. But eventually, that old crappy cell phone. It had a moisture indicator that went off, and it didn't make phone calls anymore, so it was kind of useless from that perspective. So I bit the bullet, and I managed to get myself a phone that was just about free, but of course it's free. You know, when you look at the psychology of some of this stuff, it's kind of amusing, but not really, because you are the guinea pig. But I did get a new phone, and now videos work on it again. For years, I couldn't get YouTube videos or music or any of that type of entertainment. So my cell phone was nothing more than a utility device at that point. But now this new phone works pretty well. And I found out not only can I get YouTube and I can play music, but I also can play Netflix and Amazon Prime. So it's not a good thing, because I could see how this dopamine button, bzz, 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 but this isn't what I wanted to talk about. But I could see this sucking into the machine and how easy it is, especially if you aren't aware of it. This is like smoking or something like that, where you have your first couple and you're like, oh, I'm not going to get addicted. And then a couple weeks later, you're like, oh, I can put them down at any time. It absolutely works just like that. And it is the same types of buttons that it is pushing in the brain. So listen to this. This is out of Gizmodo.com from last year, July. Fieldguide.gizmodo.com. All of the sensors in your smartphone and how they work. I wasn't going to read this one today because it's kind of off the topic, but I thought it was interesting just to take a look at what they've already been able to do in our cell phone, and now they have miniaturized a lot of these sensors, and they are ubiquitous in our environment. Your smartphone is a remarkable feat of engineering as a spy device, and it's a half dozen or more gadgets packed into a single slab. But much of the coolest feats are accomplished with a wide range of sensors, and what they are and what they actually do is quite a mystery. So how does your phone count your steps and replace your fitness tracker? And does a GPS use your data? And which sensors should you make sure are in your next handset or not? The first one is an accelerometer. The accelerometer handles axis-based motion sensing and can be found in fitness trackers as well as in phones. The reason why your smartphone can track your steps, even if you haven't bought a separate wearable. They also tell the phone software which way the handset is pointing, something that is becoming increasingly important with the arrival of augmented reality applications. As the name kind of gives away, accelerometers measure acceleration, so the map inside of Snapchat can put a cute toy car around your Bitmoji when you're driving, plus a host of other actually useful applications. I don't use anything like Snapchat, so I don't know what that is, but it sounds pretty funny. Put a cute toy car around your Bitmoji. The sensor itself is made up of sensors, including microscopic crystal structures that becomes stressed due to accelerative forces. The accelerometer then interprets the voltage coming from the crystals to figure out how fast your phone is moving and which direction it is pointing in. From the switching apps from portrait to landscape to showing your current speed in the driving app, the accelerometer is one of your phone's most important sensors. And I was thinking about that when I read the story. How long is it going to be before the state police get some sort of access to the accelerometers and all the cell phones that are in the cars driving along the expressways? So they can go, beep, 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 beep. Look, that car is doing 72 miles an hour in a 55. Pull them over. And the gyroscope is the next one, and that helps the accelerometer with understanding which way your phone is oriented. And it is another level of precision, so those 360-degree photospheres really look as impressive as possible. And actually, they are also using gyroscopes in space telescopes to be able to orient them properly, as well as in some of the DARPA drones as a backup to GPS going down, so it could still locate itself and orient itself if it lost connectivity. Whenever you play a racing game on your phone or tilt the screen to steer, the gyroscope, rather than the accelerometer, is sensing what you are doing because you are applying small turns to the phone and not actually moving through space. Gyroscopes aren't exclusive to phones. They're in altimeters inside of aircraft to determine altitude and position, for example, and to keep cameras steady on the move. And like I said, in space and in drones. The gyroscopes inside the phones don't use wheels or gimbals like the traditional mechanical ones you might find in an old plane. Instead, they are MEMS. And we've read about MEMS many times before. That is a micro-electro-mechanical system and a smaller version of the concept embedded on an electronics board so it can fit inside a phone. The first time MEMS gyroscopes really hit it big was with the iPhone 4 back in 2010. Back then, it was incredibly novel to have a phone that could detect orientation with such accuracy, and nowadays, we take it for granted. And I think that was when that something Sky app came out, where you could aim your phone at the sky and you could see all the constellations, gives you real time of all the satellites that are passing over and any of the meteor showers that are going on a star map on your phone. And I think most phones can do that now. It is a pretty neat app on a nice warm summer night. Completing the triverte of sensors responsible for working out where a phone is in physical space is the magnetometer. Now, who the hell knew that we had all these things in our phones? And again, the name gives it away. It measures the magnetic fields and thus can tell which way is north by varying its voltage output to the phone. When you go in and out of compass mode in Apple Maps or Google Maps, it is the magnetometer kicking in to work out which way the map should be. It also powers standalone compass applications. The magnetometers are found in metal detectors as well, as they can detect magnetic materials, which is why you can always get a metal detector app for your smartphone, which I didn't know about that one. However, the sensor doesn't work alone for its primary purpose, which is inside mapping applications. It operates in tandem with the data coming from the phone's accelerometer and the GPS unit to figure out your whereabouts, where you are in the world, and which way you are pointing, which is very handy for detailed navigation routes and for tracking you to figure out where you're going. But, oh, yes, the GPS, Global Positioning System technology, where would we be without you? Developed by the military. Probably in a remote, muddy field, cursing the day we ditched our paper maps for the electronic equivalents. By the way, I still have one of those big, huge national U.S. maps in my trunk that I carry with me everywhere. GPS units inside the phone get a ping from a satellite to figure out where they are and which part of the planet you're standing on or driving through, and they don't actually use any of your phone's data, which is why you could still see your location when your phone has lost signal, even if the map tiles itself into a blurry, low-resolution mess. In fact, it connects with multiple satellites. Then it calculates where you are based on your angles of intersection, kind of the way your cell phone towers work, too, to be able to ping where you are. And if no satellites can be found and you are indoors or the cloud cover is heavy, then you will not be able to get a lock, run and hide, or get between some big hills that have no cell phone or satellite signal or radio reception. And while the GPS doesn't use up your data, all this communicating and calculating can be very draining on your battery, which is why most battery-saving guides recommend you switch GPS off. Smaller gadgets, like most smartwatches, don't include it for the same reason. But don't worry, because Smart does still have it, picking up ambient radio frequencies to be able to power itself or using some sort of piezoelectric mechanism for power. And the GPS isn't the only way your phone can work out where it is. Like I said before, distance to the cell towers can also be used as a rough approximation, as Serial taught us. But if you've got some, which I don't know what that is, maybe a show, but if you've got some sort of serious navigating to do, then it is essential. Modern day GPS units inside of smartphones actually combine GPS signals with other data, like cell signal strength, to get a more accurate location. And I don't know, maybe we'll do this next little section and then we're going to move ahead back to nanotechnology. You've got plenty of more sensors in your handset, if you can even believe it. We've jammed more in there. Though they perhaps are not as important as the four that we have just mentioned, many phones, including the iPhone, have a barometer to measure air pressure, and it is useful for everything from detecting weather changes to calculating the altitude that you are at. The proximity sensor usually sits up near the top speakers and combines an infrared LED and a light detector to work out when you have the phone up to your ear so that the screen can be switched off. The sensor emits a beam of light that gets bounced back, and even though it is invisible to the human eye. And something that caught my attention about that paragraph was using infrared LED. Now, I've been reading a few things about infrared LED recently and some of my scientific research that I've been doing. One of the things that I've discovered about infrared LED is that infrared can not only pass through skin, but can penetrate into bone. And one of the new medical devices we had read about, probably 2-3 weeks ago, was one that instead of putting that gallium dye into your bloodstream and then putting you into an MRI machine, they're able to use these new headsets. And I think they're maybe just going to clinical trials right now. But they put these headsets on you that uses infrared light and shines it into your forehead. And that infrared light can pass deep down to be able to see the blood flow in the arteries and the capillaries in your brain to be able to tell whether or not you have a blood flow problem. And they are using it on stroke patients in their clinical trials. So putting the phone up next to your ear with an infrared LED that could tell whether or not it's up to your face and dim the light. Well, we read before about some dopamine, I think it was dopamine buttons, to get you as high as a kite, those headphones. And there was a connection right to the vagus nerve right next to your ear. So who knows? I mean, we've seen things with radio frequency stimulation. They can even flip cells in your body to different types of stem cells. We read about them using radio frequencies to turn cells in vivo into iPS stem cells that then they could flip to something else. They could genetically modify you with these little nanoparticles that are all in our food and in the air we breathe and the water we drink. We're going to get back to that in a few minutes. So anyway, yes, infrared LED and a light detector to work out when you have the phone up next to your ear. I never put it next to my ear. Put it on speakerphone and then talk loudly. Meanwhile, the ambient light sensor does exactly what you would expect, which was measuring the light in the room and adjusting your screen's brightness accordingly. Wink. Just like the rest of the tech packed inside of your headset, these sensors are getting smaller, smarter, and less power hungry all the time. So just when you thought you had gotten away from Big Brother, and because you're 5 years apart in your phone and your last one didn't have a GPS, doesn't mean that they're both going to be accurate. And add in the software tweaks and the optimization too, and it is more reason to upgrade your handset that you could probably get for free on a regular basis, even if you'll almost never use these sensors or see them on a spec sheet. Yes, All right, so now we're going to get back to nanotechnology, and hopefully we're not going to spend the rest of the show here, but maybe I'm going to set things up for Friday, and hopefully Camille can come on. Really, she found some disturbing things that seems to be bothering both of us. I couldn't get it out of my head, and I wasn't going to touch this stuff today at all, but it almost seems pretty important that we should. So let's get back to nanotech. We looked at it in packaging. We had discovered that good old George Bush had signed the Nanotechnology Research and Development Act back in 2003 that started in 2005 for a 5-year project to commercialize nanotechnology everywhere and anywhere. So now it's all in our packaging. It is in our food containers. They are using nanoparticulates as smoothening agents in our food. And they didn't label it after the catastrophe of GMOs that they had saw and the pushback they had from the general populace. So they figured the easiest way to do it would be not to tell us about it. And as long as they weren't changing the formula of the recipe in the food. So I don't know, we had aluminum in there. Now we're going to add nano aluminum, but don't do that because it's explosive at a nano level. They didn't have to get any further approval from the FDA. The FDA gave recommendations, wink, but they didn't have any type of regulations, and that is a big problem. So there's another publication I ran across last week when we were in the middle of nanotechnology, and it is out of the European Nanotechnology Gateway, nanoforum.org, though that website doesn't exist. It is published on a website called Nanowerk, W-E-R-K.com, called Nanotechnology in Agriculture and in Food. Now remember, they wanted nanosensors everywhere. That's why we read about the cell phone, because that's where a lot of this technology of making electronics and sensors smaller, more powerful, and less energy intensive all began. But it has gotten to the point now where it's spun out of the little box of your smartphone surveillance device, and it has gotten into everything that we know and we love and that we're surrounded by. Sorry, we're not going to read about what is nanotechnology, but let's read the next section, nanotechnology in the food market. And this is where you should be afraid. Nanotechnology has been described as the new industrial revolution, and that's just not nanotechnology. It's the smart cities and all these disruptive technologies. It is the fourth industrial revolution, 5G connectivity ubiquitously everywhere to sensors all over, and both developed and non-developing countries are investing in this technology to secure a market share. At present, the U.S. leads with a four-year $3.7 billion investment through its National Nanotechnology Initiative, and that is the one that Bush launched. The U.S. is then followed by Japan and the European Union, which both have committed substantial funds, and the level of funding in developing countries may be comparatively lower. However, this has not lessened the impact that some countries have on the global stage. For example, China, it's always China, and their share of academic publications in nanoscale science and engineering rose from 7.5% in 1995 to 18.3% in 2004, taking the country from fifth to second in the world. Other mad science labs, such as in India, South Korea, Iran, and Thailand, are also catching up with a focus on application specifics to the economic growths and the needs of their countries. Iran, for example, and remember, they're not the boogeyman like a lot of these countries they say are. And they probably have secret mad science experiments going on in deep, dark hallways in underground laboratories. Iran has a focus program in nanotechnology for the agricultural and food industry. In a recent study from the Helmuth Kaiser Consultancy, predicts that the nano food market will surge from 2.6 billion U.S. to 20.4 billion U.S. by 2010. And of course, you don't know that you're eating it yet. The report suggests that more than 50% of the world's population, which is the largest market for nano food in 2010, will be in Asia, led by China, because the Chinese have no rights and they are being engulfed by the surveillance society. And we're going to read about China if we get there today. More than 400 companies around the world today are active in nanotechnology research and development, and this number is expected to increase more than 1,000 within the next 10 years. And looks like this was out of 2004. So guys, we are like 14 years beyond this. In terms of number, the U.S. leads, followed by Japan, China, and the EU. And the estimate by the Business Communications Company, a technical market research and industry analysis company, shows that the market for nanotech was $7.6 billion in 2003 and is expected to grow to $1 trillion by 2011. And that's what this is all about. This is about economic development, people. Not about your safety, not about making you a guinea pig. It is about seeing what happens once they let all these genies and little nanotech genies out of the bottle, as well as artificial intelligence and smart electronics to bag, tag, and track everything on the planet. All right, section two, nanotechnology in agriculture. Let's get it into the food. The EU's vision is of a knowledge-based economy, And as part of this, it plans to maximize the potential of biotechnology for the benefit of the EU economy, society, and the environment. And remember, they're trying to sell all this crap as sustainable. And I'm telling you, all of it, they are trying to spin it as some sort of sustainable development. And that's why we have to upgrade ourselves and our planet. There are new challenges in the sector, including growing demand for healthy, safe food and an increased risk of disease and the threats to agricultural and fishery production from our global warming, changing weather patterns. However, creating a bioeconomy is a challenging and complex process involved in convergence of different branches of science. Nanotech is a potential to revolutionize agriculture and food industries with a new tool for molecular treatment of diseases, rapid disease detection, enhancing the ability of plants to absorb nutrients, etc. Smart sensors and smart delivery systems will help the agriculture industry combat viruses and other crop pathogens, and also their Insect Allies program. And in the near future, nanostructured catalysts will be available, which will increase the efficiency of pesticides. We read about nanopesticides last week, and herbicides, allowing for lower doses to be used. Nanotech will also protect the environment indirectly through the use of alternative renewable energy supplies, and that's where we're going to go next, and filters or catalysts to reduce pollution or clean up existing pollutants. Like the DARPA lady says, they're going to help terraform the planet back to make it safe. An agricultural methodology widely used in the U.S., Europe, and Japan, which efficiently utilizes modern technology for crop management, is called Controlled Environment Agriculture, or CEA for short. CEA is an advanced and intensive form of hydroponically based agriculture, and plants are grown within controlled environments so that horticultural practices can be optimized. The computerized system monitors and regulates localized environments of such fields of crops, and the technology as it exists today provides an excellent platform for the introduction of nanotechnology to agriculture. Many of the monitoring and control systems are already in place, and nanotechnological devices that can provide scouting capabilities could tremendously improve the grower's ability to determine the best time of harvest for the crop, the vitality of the crop, food security issues such as microbial or chemical contamination. So now they're going to sell it to you. Precision farming has long been a desired goal to maximize output while minimizing input through monitoring, ding-a-ling, environmental variables, and applying targeted actions. Don't think this is just going to be for plants. This is the plan. They are working through all the living organisms on this planet to figure this stuff out, and you are going to be next through not precision farming, but precision medicine. Precision farming makes use of computers, global satellite positioning systems, and remote sensing devices to measure highly localized environmental conditions and thus determine whether the crops are growing at maximum efficiency or precisely identifying the nature and the location of problems. Right. They're going to determine whether or not it is operating within parameters. By using centralized data to determine soil conditions and plant development, seeding, fertilizer, chemical, and water use can then be fine-tuned to lower the production costs and potentially increase production that will benefit the farmer. Precision farming can also be used to reduce agricultural waste and thus keep the environmental pollution to a minimum, hence being sustainable. Although not fully implemented yet, tiny sensors, and this is 2004, and monitoring systems enabled by nanotechnology will have a large impact on the future precision farming methodologies. One of the major roles for nanotechnology-enabled devices will be the increased use of autonomous sensors linked into GPS systems for real-time monitoring, ding-a-ling, on a dashboard. And all these nanosensors could be distributed throughout the field where they can monitor soil conditions and your crop growth. Wireless sensors are already being used in certain parts of the USA and Australia. For example, in one of the Californian vineyards, called Pickberry in Sonoma County. They have installed a Wi-Fi system that helps, with the IT company's help of Accenture. And Accenture is one of the companies working with Microsoft and the UN on that universal digital ID system, by the way. The initial cost of setting up such a system is justified by the fact that it enables the best grapes to be grown, which in turn produce finer wines, which command a premium price. And the use of such wireless networks, of course, is not restricted to vineyards. For example, Forbes magazine has reported that small nano sensors are also being used by Honeywell to monitor grocery stores in Minnesota. The technology enables shopkeepers to identify food items which have passed their expiry dates and also remind them to issue a new purchase order. And the global market for wireless sensors is predicted to be $7 billion by 2010. The Union of Biotechnology and Nanotechnology and Sensors will create equipment of increased sensitivity, allowing for an earlier response to environmental challenges. And then it goes on and on and on. Smart delivery systems, blah, blah, blah. So I'm not going to get into that. Now here's something else that I found that was interesting, a little bit off the topic, but a brand new story from last week, March 15th, 2018, is we are ingesting a lot of this nanotechnology, is nanoparticulates that have been let out of the bottle. And they don't really know how much we are eating, as per the FDA last week. They have now discovered, and this is out of nanowork.com again, that the sex of the organism, cell sex, impacts the biological uptake of nanoparticles. So it's not just how much is in our environment and they don't know how much we are ingesting, but depending upon your sex, it might also influence the amount that you are uptaking. One of the key issues in nanomedicine is the question of how to efficiently transport therapeutic nanoparticles and the associated drugs to and into the cells. Researchers have been studying the underlying mechanisms that have so far prevented successful clinical translation of a majority of medical nanotechnology applications, but don't worry about it because the cure for cancer is coming as a nanoparticle or a nanobot. And it turns out that when nanoparticles enter a biological environment such as blood, like nanobots in your blood, they immediately get exposed to a range of factors that can impact their effectiveness and their efficiency. It has become quite clear over time that the cellular response to nanomaterials depends on the physiological environment. For instance, biological responses to nanoparticles are temperature dependent. And researchers have also discovered the crucial role of biomolecular coronas to nanoparticle cell interactions. The biological responses to nanoparticles are strongly dependent on the type and the amount of associated proteins in the composition of the biomolecular corona. And eventually, I want to get to designer proteins. I have quite a number of stories queued up here. Not only are they working on splicing and dicing cells and doing CRISPR via nanoparticle, we read the other day, but they are also creating designer proteins, all in the name of cures, to get into you, to be able to fix Johnny, Susie, or Nana. So look out, people, because they are rewriting biology. Scientists have now identified yet another so far overlooked factor that impacts nanoparticle uptake. And in a new study accepted to ACS Nano, titled The Effect of Cell Sex on the Uptake of Nanoparticles, the overlooked factor at the nanobio interface, that's a new term, an international team of researchers discovered that cell sex is an important overlooked factor at the nanobio interface. More specifically, depending on their sex, cells respond differently to the exact same type of nanoparticle. Super resolution images demonstrate differences between organization, distribution, and morphology of the actin filament bundles in the cytoplasm of the amniotic mesenchymal stem cells extracted from a male versus a female fetus. Our findings have a capacity to optimize clinical translation of nanoparticles for when we get it into your body, and also help researchers better design and produce safe and efficient therapeutic sex-specific nanoparticles, says Manzuma Mahumidi, an instructor at where? Oh, Harvard Medical School. And a former director and principal investigator at Nanobio Interactions Laboratory at Tehran University of Medical Sciences, and that would be in Iran. It has been known that the differences between female and male embryos originate at a very early development stage, prior to the initiation of hormonal changes. Therefore, genetically and structurally driven sexual dimorphisms are expected at this early stage. And I don't know if we're going to get into exactly how they did the research, but just let that be a lesson to you. So it isn't just what a biological organism you are, but it also has to do with the sex of the biological organism and how they affect you. So, right, back in 2003, Bush signed the Nanotechnology Research and Development Act to be able to quickly commercialize nanotechnology. We also found out, and I mentioned this one the other day, that back in July of 2013, the Department of Energy released the Synthetic Biology Report to Congress. And I remember when we very first covered this, I was kind of perplexed as to why the Department of Energy would be into synthetic biology. But then it became very apparent that they were using it under the guise of sustainability to be able to use microorganisms to produce biofuels and different alternative fuels that could fuel the planet instead of oil in the future. But then the other day, after talking about nanotechnology for a week, Camille started doing a little bit of research, and she came across a document. This looks like it might be an excerpt out of a book from UCLA's website. This is chapter 5, titled Nanotechnology for Sustainability. And that made me chuckle a bit. Environment, water, food, minerals, and climate. Well, don't they get them all into one big thing? Nanotechnology for sustainability, environment, water, food, minerals, and climate. Yes. The global sustainability challenges facing the world are complex and involve multiple independent areas. This chapter 5 focuses on sustainable nanotechnology solutions, which is kind of an oxymoron, for a clean environment, water resources, food supply, mineral resources, green manufacturing, habitat, transportation, climate change, and biodiversity. It also discusses nanotechnology-based energy solutions in terms of their interdependence with other sustainability targets, such as water, habitat, transportation, and climate change. The vision for the next decade changes in the vision over the last 10 years. And I don't know if there's a date on this one. I don't see a date. Brundtland's Commission placed sustainability at the intersection of social, economic, and environmental factors, where sustainable development is that which meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. Sustainability entails considerations of people, the environment, and the economy. And to achieve, quote-unquote, sustainability, it is vital to take into account the complex linkages between the social system, which are the institutions that support human existence on Earth, and the global system, which is the Earth's ecosystems that support human life, as well as the human system, which are all other factors that impact health, as well as human beings. Every human being needs food, water, energy, shelter, clothing, healthcare, employment, etc. to live and to prosper on Earth, unless, of course, you have universal basic income. And one of the greatest challenges facing the world in the 21st century is providing better living conditions to people while minimizing the impact of human activities on Earth's ecosystems and the global environment. In 2000, the nanotechnology research agenda was primarily focused on the discovery, characterization, and modeling of nanoscale materials and phenomenon. And as nanotechnology continues to advance, the agenda is increasingly focused on addressing two key questions related to sustainability over the next 10 years. Number one, how can nanotechnology help address the challenges of improving global sustainability? And two, can nanotechnology be developed in a sustainable manner? Well, soon after the inception of the National Nanotechnology Initiative, it was envisioned that nanotechnology could provide more sustainable solutions to the global challenges related to providing and protecting water, energy, food, and shelter habitats. And it has been a goal of the National Nanotechnology Initiative from the outset. Maintenance of industrial sustainability by significant reduction in materials and energy use, reduced sources of pollution, increased opportunities for recycling were listed as important goals of the National Nanotechnology Initiative in 1999, and also in a subsequent address at the Cornell Nanofabrication Center in September of 2000. The National Science Foundation chair, and then it gives a lot of blurb about him, discussed how nanotechnology could improve agricultural yields for an increased population and provide more cost-efficient and cost-effective water treatment and desalinization technologies, as well as enable the development of renewable energy sources, ding, ding, including highly efficient solar energy conversion systems. Continuing along this vein, he also noted that nanotechnology promises to extend the limits of sustainable development. For example, nanoscale manufacturing, and that was Eric Drexler's dream, would provide a means for sustainable development. And that would be through less materials, less water, less energy, less manufacturing waste, and new methods to convert energy and filter water. So, all right, I'm going to scroll down here because as I started going through this PDF, this chapter 5, and I don't know if I can find it here. Oh, yes. One of the things that came up, and this was in the blurb that Camille sent me before I read it, she was questioning what nanotechnology had to do with mining. That's like mining. That's really kind of strange. Well, here's the section. I don't know, this is on page 164, titled Mineral Resources, Establish Sustainable Mineral Extraction and Use. And if you scroll down a little bit, you see that there is a diagram that looks very much like hydrofracking. And hydrofracking, if you remember, this nanotechnology initiative was passed under George Bush. And I put a couple little dots together. I was like, wait, who did George Bush have as his inner circle? Well, one of them was good old Dickie Cheney. If you remember Dickie Cheney and Halliburton connections, Halliburton was the founder of fracking, and they went a bit apeshit crazy with fracking in the reign of Bush. All right, well, natural resources derived from the Earth's lithosphere, hydrosphere, biosphere, and atmosphere are the key building blocks to sustainable human societies. And like energy and water, the availability of minerals is critical to the United States and the world economy. You know, one of the things I was thinking about is how back at the time when fracking was pushing into all kinds of beautiful, pristine environments and ruining wooded hillsides and water supplies, there was a lot of pushback at the time, and people were demanding a list of ingredients that were in the hydrofracking fluids that they were pumping down into the earth. And a lot of these companies pushed back and said, oh, no way, Jose, we're not going to give that to you because that is a protected, patented solution secret to the industry. But as I was reading this, I was thinking, well, now we know why you wouldn't tell us what was in it, because it wasn't anything really secret. It was that you were using some sort of nanotech that you didn't want us to know about. In 2006, the United States National Research Council, or more affectionately known as the NRC, estimated the added value of processed non-fuel minerals to the U.S. economy to exceed $2.1 trillion, which is a huge dollar amount, and the in-situ mining is emerging as a more efficient and environmentally sound alternative mining technology for valuable metal ions. An in-situ mining leaching is an ISM process that involves extracting valuable metal elements by the injection of a leaching solution, more commonly referred to as a lixiviant, into the ore zone of a substrate formation. And it's not calling it fracking, but if you take a look at the diagram, it sure as hell looks like fracking to me. They drill down and they pump liquids way deep down into the layers of the earth to then force out different minerals. Because this in-situ leaching examines mining and recovery of minerals or elements of interest without excavation, the underlying subsurface formation, it has become an emerging technology of choice for mining uranium, which I thought was interesting, from permeable subsurface deposits such as sandstone. And about 20% of the world's uranium production is produced by this method. Although the United States is one of the world's largest producers of minerals, it imports more than 70% of its needed minerals, much of which have been listed as critical minerals by the U.S. National Research Council. In addition to uranium used in nuclear power generation, many segments of the U.S. industry use significant amounts of minerals such as copper, manganese, lithium, titanium, tungsten, cobalt, nickel, chromium, platinum, which would include platinum, palladium, and ruthenium, as well as rare earth elements, europium, cerium, neodymium, gadolinium, ding-a-ling, and terbium. And many of these minerals will be required to build nanotechnology-based materials, devices, and systems for sustainable energy generation and storage, which is why they're going to go mine asteroids at some point in the future as well. The application of nanotechnology to mineral discovery, mining, extraction, and processing has thus far received very little attention. Right, this is the first I've ever seen of it. And in a white paper published by the Foresight Institute, they surveyed the potential application of nanotechnology in the extraction of processing valuable minerals and elements from ores. And although the U.S. Geological Survey has an active nanotechnology research program, most of its current research activities are focused on, one, bacteria-mediated synthesis of nanoparticles, and who knew that bacteria could synthesize nanoparticles, and number two, the characterization of the environmental impact of engineered nanomaterials. During the last 10 years, significant advances have been made in the development of nanoscale supramolecular hosts that can serve as high-capacity, selective, and recyclable lignans and sorbents for extracting valuable metal ions from solutions and mixtures. And these advances include the following. I'm not going to get through. Industrial manufacturing is a heavy environmental impact. First, it requires significant amounts of materials, energy, and water. And second, it generates lots of waste by toxic byproducts, blah, 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 blah. All right, so where do we go? Well, the Semiconductor Research Corporation, through the Engineering Research Center for Environmentally Benign Semiconductor Manufacturing, where, oh, at the University of Arizona, yeah, that's where they were doing a lot of that nanotech research as well, is exploring the use of nanotechnology to reduce the environmental footprint of the semiconductor industry. This includes the development of new methods for layering microchips with nanofilms, and carbon nanotubes and nanoclays are being used and evaluated as a flame retardant additive for polymeric materials. The hope is that these nanoparticles can someday replace toxic brominated fire retardant additives, and the iron-based nanocatalysts are providing new opportunities to synthesize valuable chemicals with a high yield and reduced waste generation. And I think we're going to move on to this next one, because then Camille sent me a video, and I cannot play a video on the show anymore because they messed up my Skype, so I can't do it anymore, and I don't have a mixing board here. But one of the things that this gentleman in the video talked about was the Advanced Energy Consortium. And the Advanced Energy Consortium, back in 2017, they host an all-projects review. And here's a story out of the Bureau of Economic Geology titled Advanced Energy Consortium hosts an all-project review, quote, and this is the quote from the gentleman named Scott Tinker. He says, what if we could throw smart dust, well, that's for this article, down a borehole that would tell us what subsurface formations really look like? And he was talking about fracking in that video. And he was talking about going to a convention in Colorado and them talking about utilizing smart dust to be able to get a lay of the land underground for their mining and their drilling. Says that was the big question posed by Bureau Director Scott W. Tinker 10 years ago that launched the Advanced Energy Consortium, which is a complex merger of nanotechnology and oil and gas exploration that has produced some fascinating research. So it's not just mineral investigation, it's also for oil and gas. The Advanced Energy Consortium has an annual all projects review in mid-November, and they bring together scientists, graduate students, postdocs, industry and agency representatives from all around the world to share and discuss progress made in the preceding 12 months toward answering Tinker's big question. 14 universities and other research institutions shared generated results from 20 funded projects over the last year, and specific projects were showcased on posters hosted by multidisciplinary research teams. 2 days of presentation highlighted significant research progress toward developing practical applications to address 4 use cases. And those are real-world problems that support consortium partners believing nanotechnology will be able to fix soon. 3 of the use cases involved using nanoparticles to map fracture systems underground, tracking water flood, enhanced oil recovery operations, or addressing problems with water flood effectiveness. The Advanced Energy Consortium has developed time-released nanoscale payload delivery particles to transport important cargo to specific parts of the subsurface reservoir. And the 4 of the cases, the scientists move even closer to developing tiny nanosensors that can report downhole conditions such as the temperature and the pressure underground. And at the review, researchers also shared data from field tests of these nanotechnologies conducted recently in places such as the Bureau's Divine Test Site to better simulate the harsh and complex conditions in the subsurface environment. Sponsoring partners of the Advanced Energy Consortium have invested over $50 million in the productive research efforts over the years. And current sponsors include, oh yes, here's a great bunch, ExxonMobil, which hosted this year's All Projects Review in 2017, Shell, Total, Repsol, HP Billion, and the U.S. Department of Energy through the Sandia National Laboratories. The Bureau of Economic Geology, which continues to serve as the coordinating institution for the Advanced Energy Consortium, is very grateful for the support of its vital big oil sponsors. And for more information about the company and about how you, your company, or your institution can get involved in this cutting-edge research, please contact us. All right. So, all right, here's another one. This is going to be the last one because we only have 3 minutes to go, but we'll end it up here. Maybe Camille can come on with us Friday, and we can look a little more at the connections she has found. This is a story out of Huffington Post that she sent to me, dated November 6, 2014, titled Bush Family, Inner Circle at Center of Lawsuits versus Denton, Texas fracking ban. And if anybody lives down in Texas, you know that there is an oil boom going on in Texas right now. And if you've ever zoomed in on Southwest Texas in Google Maps and taken a good look, you're going to see all these dots and these connections that look like a little computer network all over the ground. But those are fracking wells. Fracking is alive and well in Southwest Texas. On November 4th, 2014, Denton, Texas became the first city in the state to ban the process of hydrofracking when 59% of voters cast ballots in favor of the initiative. It did so in the heart of the Barnett Shale Basin, where George Mitchell, the father of fracking, drilled first sample wells for his company, Mitchell Energy. As promised by the oil and gas industry and by the Texas Railroad Commission Commissioner David Porter, the vote was met with immediate legal backlash. Both the Texas General Land Office and the Texas Oil and Gas Association filed lawsuits in Texas courts within 12 hours of the vote taking place, which is the latest action in an aggressive months-long campaign by the industry and the Texas state government to fend off the ban. So 59% of the voters cast in favor of banning fracking, and the state itself went against the people with industry to force it, which that should tell you something. The land office and the TXOGA, which is the Oil and Gas Association lawsuits, besides making similar legal arguments about the state law preempting local law under the Texas Constitution, share something else in common, and that is ties to former President George W. Bush and the Bush family at large. The land office's legal case, through the land commissioner, Jerry Patterson, who signed off on the lawsuit, and George Prescott Bush, which is the son of former Florida governor and prospective 2016 Republican Party presidential nominee Jeb Bush, good old Jeb, poor Jeb, and nephew of the former president G.W. Bush, will take his place. George P. Bush won his land commissioner race in a landslide, gaining 61% of the vote. And given the cumbersome and lengthy nature of litigation in the U.S., it appears that the land office will only have a case once it has been time for Bush to assume the office. So the Texas Oil and Gas Association legal complaint was filed by a powerful team of attorneys working at the firm called Baker Botts, which is an international law firm named after the familial descendants of James A. Baker III, a partner at the firm. Baker III served as the chief of staff under both President Ronald Reagan and George W.H. Bush, as well as Secretary of State under George W. Bush, and a close advisor to President George Bush on the U.S. occupation of Iraq. He gave George P. Bush a $10,000 donation for his campaign for his race for land commissioner. Ding-a-ling-a-ling! All right, guys, make sure you stick around. It is Wednesday, and I will catch up with you on Friday. Everybody, take care.